This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli wa sallim wa barik ala nabiyyina wa habibina Muhammad wa ala ahlihi wa sahbihi ajma'in wa ba'd. So today, inshaAllah ta'ala, we continue with the seerah of the Prophet alayhi salatu wa salam. Next week, we'll be off, since it's the week of Eid. I usually take that week off. I'll give the Jum'ah khutbah, obviously, inshaAllah, keep that piece moving, but we'll kind of take the rest of the halaqat off for a week. Today, we'll continue with the seerah. I would often, during these halaqat, before Eid, Hajj, and certain, maybe give a Hajj special, but instead of doing that today, I'm going to just give the seerah halaqah, and then if you want to hear a little bit about the journey of Hajj or learn a little bit more, then tomorrow, similar timing around 7:45, I'll do like a journey of Hajj type of presentation and talk a little bit about Hajj. There'll be some dua, and then there's an iftar here. I don't know if what the numbers are looking like in terms of the attendees and whatnot, but regardless, you're welcome to kind of come and check it out. So, the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam in the last episode or two had come up with the idea of going to Habasha or Abyssinia. And we talked about the events that took place once he actually sent people there, like how it actually kind of transpired once he sent people, what happened after he sent people, where Quraysh sent two people to try and retrieve them and bring them back, and they failed, and how the Sahaba had to build a life for themselves in a foreign land, foreign people, foreign language, foreign culture, foreign religion. So they had to kind of figure their way through. And I spent a reasonable amount of time talking about how I feel that the best example for us as Muslims here in the West is the Muslims who went to Habasha during his life, alayhi salatu wasalam. There's really not much of a better, I'm not aware of a better analogy for our situation here in the West. And really, we talked about some of the surahs that they utilized or that was given to them before they left, and how these surahs were very meaningful to them. And we also kind of pointed out the fact that they were productive in their society, and they earned their right to stay there, and they earned the respect of the communities that the community they lived within, because they actually brought something to the table that was valuable, and how they performed a lot of da'wah. When they came back 15 years later, there were way more Muslims with them, not just their descendants, but also people who accepted Islam, who till this day, many of them live in Mecca and Medina. The Ahbash are still a part of the societal construct of that part of the world. And I talked about also how a group of them came back because of a rumor that started in Mecca, and we kind of explained what that rumor was. And I talked about the story of Uthman ibn Mad'un, which I think I ended the last week with that story. And the question at the end of it was, do you feel like you belong, or do you not? And that's really the moral of the story of Sayyidina Uthman ibn Mad'un. Although he was very well protected within Mecca, he didn't want to be. All of his friends, all of the Muslims that he was surrounded by were not well protected, and they were suffering and struggling. And for him, it was not imaginable that he stayed protected and preserved and comfortable in his life, and everyone else that he spent time with were mistreated. So he rejected that protection that he had from the mushrik, from the person who was, when we look at it, was actually one of the enemies of Islam. Walid ibn Mughira, who offered him protection, was one of the people who was persecuting Muslims as well. So he rejected his protection, and of course that caused him physical pain. But when he was asked, he told him, the expression, or the sentence that he uttered at that point was that, my healthy side cannot wait for it to undergo what my affected side has gone through for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm happier now than I was when I was under your protection. And that can only be said or felt if the person has that sense of belonging, has that sense of belonging to the community that they're a part of. And this is something that is important. It's really important. It's extremely important. And it's more important here than it is probably in other parts of the world where there are majority, Muslims are more of a majority. Here, it's absolutely required. If you don't have that sense of belonging here, then it's really the waves of other ideologies and the waves of change and of different ways of thought and will pull you away. Like they will completely wash you ashore or remove you from where you are altogether. There has to be something that anchors you in order for you to be able to hold your ground and stand your ground. And what's going to anchor you for sure is going to be that sense of belonging, that you're part of an ummah, you're part of a community. So there's something that you belong to, that you are happy that you're a part of, and whatever difficulties that come your way are trivial in contrast to the actual ummah, nation that you're a part of. And that's really, to me, the answer for a lot of the questions that come up in terms of how do we raise our children, how do we keep our children, how do we keep our youth. And how, they have to have a sense of belonging. That's they have to feel like they're a part of something. Youthful minds, youthful hearts need to feel like they're a part of something, or else they lose interest really quickly. Not everyone does. Not every younger person feels that they're part of something, but they try to. And if they can't find it within our community, within our ummah, then they'll find it online. They'll find some way to belong. They'll find it at school. They'll find it somewhere else where they feel that they belong. And you can belong to more than one thing, but for sure, if you don't feel like you belong to the Muslim community, then it's going to be very hard for you to contribute and to participate and to actually spend time and to volunteer and to work and to learn, to grow. And people always ask, why do they game so much? Because they feel like they belong there. Because there's a sense of belonging in the gaming world that maybe a lot of parents aren't aware of. You see, in the gaming world, for those who don't feel like they belong elsewhere, they build teams and clans and groups and they start to feel like they belong to that. And they feel like they have some friendships and they have people that they know and they have value to their team and people look forward to see them. Not necessarily see them, but hear them or know that they're present. People need that. Everyone needs that. And we have it, it's at our footsteps. It's very easy for us as a Muslim community to make sure that everyone feels like they belong and feel that they're welcome and feel that their presence is requested and needed and that their absence is noticed. And their absence matters and that their opinion is important and that it's not very hard, but selfish hearts can't do it. Selfish egos and selfish hearts and stuff, but they can't do it. So when masajid and institutions are run by people who are selfish, there's a selfishness attached to the way the masajid or the institutions are run, then the people who come in don't feel that they are needed, required, welcome, or belong. So they'll come for a while because there's an obligation upon them to do so, because they're like, well, we should pray more, I should come for Jumu'ah. There's that thought process that, I have to do it. But after a while, that wears off. It does. Wallah, wears off. It wears off and life will, you'll give yourself excuses. I'm too busy, I have this, I have that. You stop going. And believe me, someone who feels like they belong, they will make time to come to a masjid. They will claw and fight and make sure that they make it, because that's where they feel a sense of being, a sense of importance, a sense of significance, a sense of belonging. And that's what the Prophet ﷺ offered the Sahaba. He offered these people a sense of value. They were valuable. He asked about them. When they didn't show up, he asked, where is Fulan? Probably the first time Bilal ibn Habashi was ever asked about. There's actually a narration of Suhaib talking about this, where the Prophet ﷺ asked about him, and he said, he asked about me. Why? Did he want something? No, he was seeing where you were. So you're telling me the Prophet ﷺ was just noticed, he noticed I wasn't there, and just said, where is Fulan? He didn't believe it. He had to go back and ask. He asked about me. He spent all his life, no one cared if he came, if he showed up or he didn't show up, or if he was present or not, no one cared. And the Prophet ﷺ actually took time to make sure he noticed everyone, he asked about them. He taught the Sahaba to do that towards one another. And when they did that, that sense of community was built and people wanted to be a part of something. You understand how easy that is for us to build in our community? It's really easy. It's one of the easiest things. It takes no money, no fundraising. It takes nothing. It doesn't need knowledge. It just needs hearts that are not too selfish. That's all. Just a little bit of compassion, a little bit of... it's really simple. Like the investment for the return is insane. You invest nothing. It's just you just ask about someone. Just make sure that you keep everyone has a few people who keep them on their radar, and they keep track, and they phone, and they ask about them, and they make sure when they come here, they find them. They bring to the masjid. We do that to everyone involved, and everyone does that for someone else, and if everyone's covered, and khalas, the return is amazing. The return is people feel at home at masjid. They come and they attend and they participate and they bring their kids, and their kids also feel that way, and then khalas. If you're telling me, my kids don't want to come to the masjid, do they have friends at the masjid? No, then of course they don't want to come. I wouldn't want to go either. I wouldn't want to come to a place where I had no friends. I wouldn't want to go to a place where I feel awkward, I feel out of place, I don't know anyone, no one cares if I come or not, there's nothing to do that's fun. Yani what? This is fun. I'm not fun. Listening to me is not fun. You can't categorize this for a kid that this is fun, where he sits and listens to an old fat sheikh talk to him about something and yell at them. That's not fun. But there can for sure be things that they can do here that can feel fun. And in the midst of it all, we pray and we make dua and we give a lesson, and someone hears something that's khair and maybe it registers for a moment, and then they talk about it, and that's how it continues. You can't expect children to want to go and do talab ilm. It's insane. You barely do it. You, as someone who understands exactly why you should do it, you barely do it. You expect a child to do it. I don't understand. We have very weird expectations of others, and understanding that doesn't seem to fit for me. Anyways, that's what I wanted to get. That was the end of my rant on that piece, but I didn't talk about it last time, so I wanted to kind of share it with you today, and then we can move on to the piece after, inshallah. So what happens next is actually quite critical. To the story of the Prophet ﷺ. So it's part of the story that is rarely talked about outside of the seerah, right? There's a lot of stories that are brought up. For example, you'll hear about Badr and Uhud and Khandaq, for example, on the minbar. You don't hear a lot about Hisar al-Shi'b. I myself don't do a very good job at bringing it up at the right time, even though opportunities present themselves and I still forget. It's one of those pieces that just don't come up outside of seerah, but it's very critical and very important. So what happened here was that the Prophet ﷺ, they thought of assassinating him. This happened 9 times throughout his life, by the way, just as a record for you to know the number. 9 times they tried to kill him throughout his life. Never once did he decide maybe having a bodyguard or having someone to stand. No, he didn't. Outside of war and having someone stand in front of the tent, which is the norm for any leader, any war commander, you need to have someone protect them, because dying in the midst of war is a musibah. Like, if you can get to the leader in the midst of war, that usually means the war is lost, because it's just at that point you need it. It was too much of a strike to the morale and also for the plan itself. Outside of that, alayhi salam never really employed anyone to do this, nor did he care for it. However, this was the first time. So year number 7, around 7, because we're going to talk about year number 7, 8, and 9, these 3 years. The beginning of year number 7 is when the first time where they started talking about killing him, alayhi salatu wasalam. Now, they brought it up once in terms of, here, give us, we'll give you one person, Abu Talib, give us someone in return, and then we'll take care of it. And but that wasn't an assassination, that was more of an arranged agreement type of thing. But here they were thinking that, okay, we have to take him out. This is not working anymore. So this discussion began to occur on a formal level. Within Dar al-Nadwa, where they would actually meet and talk politics, they start to bring it up. Abu Talib heard about it. He gets really upset. Abu Talib was someone who's very calm and very wise. And he would often not someone to react quickly or react rashly. No, he was always someone who took his time. But when he heard them, when it came to his attention that they were talking about killing him, alayhi salatu wasalam, right? And they were discussing, well, how do we do it? What is the method of doing this, since Abu Talib is protecting him? Abu Talib got very upset. So he did something. So he called upon 20 young men from Bani Hashim. Young strapping lads, and he gave them each a 2x4, like a pole, not really a sword, but rather something's not a weapon but can be used as a weapon, but not a weapon. And he was very smart by doing this. And he agreed with them that was what we're going to do. You're going to go with me. Keep the pole that you have, a 2x4. Keep it in your jacket. Don't let anyone see it. Conceal it. Make sure it's unseen. And the Prophet ﷺ was not aware of this issue. He was not brought into this story. The story is very specific to Abu Talib's reaction. So Abu Talib would take these gentlemen, and he would wait for the day of the meeting in Dar al-Nadwa, and he would go. He was not. He would sometimes go and attend these meetings, but he was not a formal part of the council of Mecca. Let's call it that way. Why? Just because of old age. Just because he had gotten older, and they gave it to people who were a little bit younger. When I say by younger, I mean like in their 50s. But people, he was like in his 70s at that point, or early 70s. So he was an older gentleman, and he was, but he still was involved. He knew when the times of the meeting was meetings were. So he went when the meeting was occurring, and he basically barged right into the meeting of Dar al-Nadwa. And he explained to the Shabab of Bani Hashim what to do. So he told each one behind who to stand. So they went and they stood they stood around the table behind the people who were meeting. And he starts to talk to them, and he tells them, بلغني أنكم تتحدثون عن قتل ابن أخي. It came to my attention that you seem to be discussing amongst yourselves the killing or the assassination of my nephew. And then they start, because they, you know, usually when people talk in secret or in confidence, they assume that it stays secret. So they were talking, they didn't know that everything you say gets out. All right? I'll repeat that for you again. Everything you say in life gets out. Everything. So think about all the stuff you said. And you think they're confident. They're in confidence. They ain't. They'll get out. If you have a secret you really care about, let me give you a piece of advice. Keep it to yourself. Just keep it to yourself. The moment you open your mouth and you flap your lips with something, it's just a matter of time before it leaves and it goes out. Maybe the exception of the clinic in a room with a physician. Maybe physicians, maybe therapists, people who are paid and their licensure is actually dependent on confidentiality. Outside of that, you tell someone, this has to stay between us, no one needs to talk about this. You just delay the takeoff, that's all. You just keep the plane in the runway for a slightly longer time than intended, but it will take off. It will for sure take off. So, and this is an issue of wisdom. I'm giving you wallahi, this is a free piece of wisdom. I should charge you for this. Wallahi, I should charge you wealth money on the way out for this piece of wisdom. Everything you say, people know. Everything you say reaches the ears of the people you didn't want them to hear. Everything in life, everything. It's just a matter of time. So if you truly don't want someone to hear something, then don't say it altogether. Or just find a way to go tell it to them directly. Or say it in a way where you can deal with it once they hear it. Because absolutely everything you say makes its way out. You think it won't. And you look at me and say, no, Fulan is a vault. Yes, you think so. Fulana, she won't say anything. All right. Time will prove you wrong. And you'll come back and you'll say, yes, you are right, Sheikh. Yes, I know I'm right. Not because I know anything you don't. It's because I've been living longer than you. And those who have lived longer than me, they know what I'm saying is true. Everything you say, it makes its way out. Everything. So just be careful. So anyways, these people sitting there thinking that they're talking about something confidential no one knows about. Like, how does Abu Talib know? Yeah, what do you mean? Of course it's going to be known. Something like that. People can't hold on to secrets that long. So they all start to mumble and they start to kind of look away and they don't want to admit it, but at the same time they feel very embarrassed that he caught them. فَقَالَ أَتَدْرُونَ مَا هَمَمْتُ بِهِ. Do you know what I've intended? And they look up and say, فَقَالَ يَا شَبْ. And then he gave the signal to the Shabab. So the Shabab, Bani Hashim, knew they were sitting behind on the walls. And he had given them a signal. When I give you a signal, you stand up and you do the following. So he, فَنَظَرَ إِلَيْهِمْ. فَقَامُوا فَنَظَرُوا فَإِذَا كُلُّ وَاحِدٍ مِّنْهُمْ يَحْمِلُ فَوْقَ رَأْسِهِ حَدِيدًا. They all stood up and they took out the pole and they stood on top of the heads of the people who were sitting. So Abu Jahl is sitting there, he looks up, there's a strapping young gentleman with a 2x4 sitting right in front of his head. And they all go quiet. And he says, Wallahi, لو قتل محمد لأقاتلنكم حتى نتفانى. If you touch him, then we will fight until we are all gone, until no one's left, until Mecca's empty. If you touch him, then we will fight till no one is left, absolutely no one. And then he took the guys and left. He took the guys and left. Now, if it was a sword, it would have been a declaration of war. He didn't want to, so he gave them just a 2x4. Because if it was a sword, then that would be that's a direct threat, and it's a symbolic for war. He didn't want to declare war. He wanted to make a very clear threat that if anyone was to touch the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, then yes, there was going to be unimaginable consequences. And he did. And I love this story because when you hear the story, you just feel so, I don't know. He gives you this sense of integrity, this sense of strength, of bravery, of courage. Abu Talib, subhanAllah, did more for Islam without necessarily even being Muslim, as far as we don't even know, without necessarily at least being openly Muslim than most Muslims do today. And it's a very depressing thought that someone who never declared themselves as Muslim still ended up defending Islam and bringing integrity and strength and courage and bravery to Islam and to Muslims more than most Muslims do today. And Abu Talib, rijal, right, as they say. That manliness, that courage, where he heard something and he went and he ended it right then and there. And that's something we need. We don't need violence. Yeah? No. Muslims say we don't need violence. I think we have enough of that. We don't need violence. And Islam is not defended through violence or via violence. And if you're listening to the seerah appropriately, you know that the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, and the ground rule that he gave to the Sahaba, when you accepted Islam with him, the ground rule was absolutely no violence. You can't fight back. Yeah, they can torture you, they can persecute you, they can take your wealth. You can't fight back. You can't, pull your sword and fight them. You're in Mecca, you have to put up with it or leave. Put up with it or leave. The people who are going to be killed, the people who were going to be killed and couldn't fight back, he sent them to Habasha. And people who didn't have enough pull to defend themselves and were getting close because they can't fight back. And the Prophet can't keep them in Mecca to be killed. So he sent them to Habasha. He sent with them all the other people that he sent with so that they don't feel like they're being thrown away because they don't have support. But that was one of the reasons Habasha was needed, is because you couldn't fight back. You weren't allowed to pull your sword and fight back. Well, what am I going to do? I don't have support. I don't have anyone to protect me. I'm not part of a clan or a tribe. So what do I do? You're just going to get killed? I can't live my life in secrecy all the time. It's impossible. So he sent some people who couldn't protect themselves or he couldn't protect. He sent them to Habasha because he didn't want their lives to expire. But that's how committed to the no violence piece he was. He was so committed that he sent people to a different continent. Rather than telling him, okay, you have the rukhsah to fight back, or you're allowed, you have the exception. No exception. You can't fight back. Either you live here, get out, go live somewhere else. So he gave them a place, he gave them a destination to go to. And by the way, one last piece about Habasha, is that, yes, he sent a group of people to live there, but over the next 4 and 5 years before Hijrah, people kept on trickling into Habasha. Like the immigration continued. It wasn't just a one-time bulk. No. They continued to go to Habasha. People who felt that they could not survive in Mecca anymore and did not, they would go to Habasha. That's why you have names who weren't there at the beginning and were there at the end. We know that because people who didn't go, who weren't a part of the initial group, later on were there for a couple of years. Why? Because they couldn't stay in Mecca. No one went to Habasha after the Hijrah to Medina. But before that, people kept on trickling into Habasha who couldn't protect themselves. And the reason being is that absolutely no violence. So I'm not talking about violence. What I'm talking about is a stand of strength, taking a stance of strength and courage. And we need for sure, we definitely need more of that than we have today. And I have to say that the encampments on campuses all across North America and Europe and even parts of Japan apparently is something that's very inspiring and it's beautiful. And it's nice to see young people get their backbones, young people find their footing in this world. Because for too long, our younger generation has been bred via fear. For a very long time, most younger people are raised to be fearful, to fear the system and to fear the tyranny of the different political regimes that exist. And that has crippled us as a nation. As an ummah, we've been crippled because of this upbringing. And especially after the failure, if that's an appropriate phrase, of the what they called the Arabic Spring that occurred in the early 2010s, it reinforced some of that. Like it reinforced some of this fear, this upbringing in fear. And if we hope to see change for our nation, 100% our youth have to grow up a little bit more courageous, a little bit more brave, and a little bit more capable of taking stands and voicing their concerns and finding their footing in this world and not living in fear of anything really, and that's important. So he did that. Abu Talib did that, and it was absolutely humiliating to Quraysh. But it sent a message that don't mess with us when it comes to trying. You're not going to kill him. Do not mess with us. But Abu Talib didn't stop there. No, Abu Talib came up with an idea. Abu Talib, I didn't put it here. So what he did was he went and he told the Prophet ﷺ, they're thinking of killing you. In order for you to stay safe, we have to change the setup. So he ordered all of Bani Hashim. So again, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, ibn Abd al-Muttalib, ibn Hashim. Right, Abu Talib is the son of Hashim. Hashim has multiple children. Right, that all those children and all their descendants, which at this point, the great-grandchild, Abu Talib is, sorry, the son of Abdul Muttalib, his grandfather is Hashim, forgive me. So Hashim has different children, Abdul Muttalib being one of them. There's a bunch of them that are Al-Muttalib and others. And this Banu Hashim were known for certain things, and the Prophet alayhi salam's tribe. And they lived all across Mecca, but they did have a neighborhood. There was a specific area in Mecca that was their Shi'b. It's called Shi'b. It's called a neighborhood. So he ordered all of Bani Hashim to come and live in that neighborhood. He brought people down from the mountains. If you were rich back then, you could live a bit higher. You have a better view, fresher air, and you don't have to, so if you had more money, you're higher up in the mountains. And if you were poor, you were more, closer to the ground, but not high up as in too, being too far from the Kaaba, but just high up in the, just like today. If you're really rich, you're in one of those high skyscraping hotels in front of the Kaaba. Not much has changed. So Abu Talib commanded all of Bani Hashim to come to the neighborhood of Shi'b Bani Hashim. So they did. And then he set it up in a way where the Prophet ﷺ was centered right in the middle. So he would stay there. Even though Bani Hashim, by the way, are they Muslim? Are Bani Hashim all Muslim? No, not even close. Like the majority of Bani Hashim aren't Muslim. The majority at that point, obviously they all became Muslim later. But at this point, the majority of them were not Muslim yet. So Abu Talib was not doing this via religion. He was doing this via family. He was doing this via the fact that this is what makes sense. Life is being threatened for a reason that is not valid. So we need to protect him. So he sent to the Prophet alayhi salam in the middle of Banu Hashim. So Quraysh that wanted to retaliate after Abu Talib did that, after he brought those Shabab in, they couldn't anymore, because now the Prophet ﷺ was beyond reach. He was protected. It was impossible. They couldn't get to him anymore. So they got even more upset. Abu Talib took it to an extreme that this is not happening, and I'm going to change everything. I'm going to bring people. People are going to move from their homes. We're going to put different setups so that you can't touch him. So Quraysh also retaliated, but Quraysh, they played dirty, which takes us to the boycott of the clan of Hashim. This is this will occur for quite some time. It's a part of the seerah that's important for us to learn about, because there's a lot of lessons here that are worth learning. So Abu Jahl and Abu Sufyan and Abu Bukhturi ibn Hisham and Al-Walid and Al-As and all these other leaders of Quraysh, they gathered and they said that since Muhammad is doing this to us, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and that since the Banu Hashim are actually protecting him and showing almost defying us, or they're in opposition to us, then we have to boycott them. فَقَالُوا لَا يَدْخُلُونَ عَلَيْنَا وَلَا نَدْخُلُ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا نَبْتَاعُ مِنْهُمْ وَلَا يَبْتَاعُونَ مِنَّا وَلَا نَتَزَوَّجُ مِنْهُمْ وَلَا يَتَزَوَّجُونَ مِنَّا. So they came up with three articles. First one is that they don't leave and they don't come to Mecca, and we don't go into their neighborhood. Meaning they put a ban, or no one can leave this area anymore. They can't come into us, we can't get into them. They can go from the other side, outside of Mecca, but that's as far as it goes. They can't buy from us, we don't buy from them. Meaning the trade between the people of Mecca and Quraysh and the people of Banu Hashim stops, and marriage stops. So those are the three things that they agreed to. And they wrote it on a document and they hung it inside the Kaaba. And they all gave their ayman al-mughallaba that they would stand by. Meaning they brought from every tribe in Mecca the leader or the representative that would offer the oath or the vow to stick to this document. That those who don't stick this document will also be boycotted by Quraysh. So they made it official. And it actually occurred. And it was communicated to Banu Hashim. And guards were put out on the outside of the clan of Hashim. Like the exit of the neighborhood into Mecca, they put blockades. They couldn't get out anymore. There were people who were standing there, like on an ongoing on-call shifts. There were people standing there with swords, and they weren't allowed to leave. Abu Lahab went a little bit farther. Abu Lahab didn't, he's from Bani Hashim, but he refused. Abu Lahab is Abu Talib's brother, but he refused to do it. He said, I'm not coming. I told you guys at the beginning that this was a bad idea. I told you guys at the beginning when we had the feast. Then I told you guys again when he got on the mountain, and no one's listening to me. And now look where you are. Now look what's happening. I'm not involved. You can go and live in your neighborhood. I'm not going to the neighborhood to live with you. So he refused. Now only did he refuse, Abu Lahab, and this is, again, I remember I pointed out to you that when you go through the seerah, you can count how many times Abu Lahab mistreated the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. And the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam is complete silence. This complete silence. Never once did he speak back to him. Never once did he disrespect him ever, alayhi salatu wasalam. And this is an important aspect of his character. He never did. But Abu Lahab, again, what did he do this time? He went after all the merchants that would come by Banu Hashim, and he promised them that whatever it is that they want to buy from you, come to me, I'll pay you 3 times the amount. Just don't sell it to them. Just don't sell them anything, because there was no selling and buying from the people of Quraysh, but merchants, outside merchants who aren't Qurayshi, who aren't part of Mecca, who will come from the opposite side of the neighborhood, on the other side of the neighborhood, can buy and sell. So he promised them, because he was a well-known businessman, a well-known merchant, he promised them that anything that they offer you, anything that Banu Hashim offers you in terms of wealth to buy something, like whatever price they are offering you for whatever merchandise you have, come to me, times it by 3, I'll pay you. And just don't give it to them. With the intention of starving them. Like he was trying to starve Banu Hashim. Right? You see, we tend to think, this is my analysis of this. We tend to think that our enemies are so evil. Honestly, the most harm you get in your life comes from those who are close to you. Like, the most harm that ever is inflicted on you in life doesn't come from your enemy. It comes from someone who's too close to you to actually say anything, where they completely just, they paralyze you. Because what are you going to say? What is the Prophet alayhi salam going to say about Quraysh if Abu Lahab is doing this? You say, how can you blame Quraysh if Abu Lahab is doing this? If his own uncle alayhi salam is behaving this way? You think the people in Gaza are dying because of what the Israeli government is doing? You think that's the only reason? You think that's the actual problem? That's not the actual problem. It's not the actual problem. Yes, there's an apartheid government that is racist and it's an occupying transgressive colonialistic movement. But the real problem is not them. The real problem is the millions and millions and millions of Muslims who are right beside them. All the Muslim governments that carry borders that are longer than borders of hundreds of kilometers, who are right there, who have no interest of doing anything. Those who actually are Muslims who are hoping that this whole resistance that is left in the hearts of the Palestinian people is taken away. Whatever resistance to this apartheid state is taken away. That is what breaks people's backs. Like that's what ends things. That's what the Prophet alayhi salam told us later on in his life about our ummah. That really is not the fear of external enemies that you're going to be worried about. It's the problem from within. Your problems will always be from within you. It'll be within your nation. It'll be within your ummah. It'll be the munafiqun that you have amongst you, and the traitors, and the people who just are the indifferent ones, the ones who just don't do carry their weight. That's what your problem is going to be. It's not going to be your external enemy. Your external enemy may carry some, but it's nothing that's worth. It's an illusion. It's really you, and that's always been the reality of the matter. You're going to find that a lot in life, even in your personal life, that you're thinking about all these individuals that are out to get you, and then you're going to find that really. It's يَا لَذِينَ آمَنُوا إِنَّ مِنْ أَزْوَاجِكُمْ وَأَوْلَادِكُمْ عَدُوًّا لَكُمْ فَاحْذَرُوهُمْ. And you'll find that it's from your own house. That's where it'll hurt the most. And that's where it'll kind of literally paralyze you. And the Prophet alayhi salam's own uncle, and he doesn't like this, why? Why would you do something like this? And he did it. He made sure that they starved. And it started that way. It started with a little bit of I want you to think about it. Like they're in the neighborhood, and now I think I put a picture of it somewhere. So this is what it looks like. This is Shu'ab Bani Hashim over here. This is the Haram, and this is where the Shu'ab is. And this is what it looks like in terms of this is where the houses were up into the mountain. This is Shu'ab Bani Hashim. I have another. I think I don't. That's it. Yeah, that's the only picture I have. But this is where they lived. And you can imagine for the first week or so, things were fine. Because there's a little bit of food in the house. But after a couple of weeks, after the resources that they had start to run out. Think about that. If you go home today and we just lock the door on you, you'll be fine initially. Initially, you'll be all right. Like, it's no big deal. Next day, that's all right. Day after that, all right. A couple of weeks in, you run out of the basic resources. No more cereal, no more milk, no more eggs. There's no more bread. There's no more rice. Things are starting to, you're stuck with a bit of spices and salt and maybe a little bit of tea and water. And so slowly the water starts to run out because we cut the water off and you don't have electricity. And after a while, slowly, you get squeezed. You get squeezed. And the people of the Banu Hashim, they got squeezed. They got squeezed real hard. It was very difficult. After a couple of months, people started to starve. After a couple of months, people started to starve. They would. The interesting part of this is that, as I told you, the majority of Banu Hashim weren't even Muslim. Like, they weren't Muslim, but they stuck to it. They stuck to what they thought was right. And one of the important lessons of this is that, if it wasn't for the fact that the Muslims themselves were people of great character, then the non-Muslims of Banu Hashim would have not stuck with this by any measure. Like, they wouldn't. Why would you go through something like this for a group of people that they're disrespectful, they're rude, they're not, they don't take care, they don't take care of their own waste, they don't treat people appropriately, they don't carry their own weight, they're not, they wouldn't. But it's because of the character of the Muslims, the early Muslims, the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam himself, and the people who were with him. Because not only were the Banu Hashim in the clan, in the neighborhood, a lot of Muslims had to follow him alayhi salatu wasalam out of fear for their own lives. Not everyone was in there, but there was a fair amount of Muslims inside of this clan, inside of the neighborhood. But non-Muslims and Muslims within this period, this was going on for 3 years. For around 3 years, this whole story would go on. Now, what you and I know is it'll end after 3 years. They didn't. They had no idea this would ever end. This was a document that was signed and held and hung in the Kaaba. These type of things don't usually ever go away. Like, usually this stays forever and ever. But they stuck to it. And they worked together in harmony. I always think about this because I find it something worth reflection. If the Muslims were if the way the Muslims looked at non-Muslims was the way a lot of Muslims today see non-Muslims, which is extremely negative and very condescending, honestly, and very then they wouldn't. If a Muslim was like, there, oh, so you're sticking with us, you know you're going to Jahannam anyways, right? You're a mushrik. You're not going to make it. They wouldn't. Why would they do this? If the communication was of that sort or in that of that level, then no one would have stuck. They wouldn't. They probably, the Muslims are like, you know what? You all should be killed. Actually, we'll just do it for them. We'll do it as a token of appreciation to Quraysh. They let us back in. We'll just take them all out. But they didn't. They stuck with them. It's really interesting because, they got so hungry. Oops. What did I do? Good. Yeah. The wording that they use here, until they ate tree leaves. This is the wording of the Sahaba, that they got so hungry during these 3 years that they would go and they would pick leaves off trees and they would eat the tree leaves. By the way, most of the trees back then were palm trees. Ever seen a palm tree leaf? Like, it's not something that's edible. This is how hungry they became. People, there are people from Banu Hashim that would beg, that would plead with merchants. They would go, they would plead with merchants, begging them for anything, just to feed their children, just to feed their starving children. And they still wouldn't, because Abu Lahab and others had already had threatened them that if you sell, we'll stop doing business with you, or we'll pay you more, or whatever. Imagine people standing there begging, "I don't want food for me. Just feed this child. Why starve this child to death?" And people died. To make sure you understand how difficult this story is that within these years there are people who died: children, women, men, and elderly who died in the clan of Bani Hashim, this boycott, from starvation, from lack of nutrition. Actually, at the end of the story, I'm going to talk to you about two people who would die, who also died as a consequence of the 3 years of starvation that happened. We're talking about Abu Talib and Khadija al-Kubra alayhi salam. We'll talk about these people who died for the same reason, but didn't happen during, it happened after, a little bit after, but it was the consequence of people going through this. The Prophet alayhi salam became very, very thin. And he went, his weight changed alayhi salatu wasalam within these years.
But also imagine them with me, that for 3 years, there was no da'wah happening.
They couldn't leave. They couldn't get out of the neighborhood to speak to anyone. So you already had a small number of Muslims to begin with. Like already the number of Muslims was very low. And now for 3 years, which is not a small, that's not a short period of time. If you look at the full period of time of his da'wah, how long was his da'wah altogether? 23 years. Three of those years, there was nothing. Understand the problem here? Yeah, you're talking, that's the 1 out of 8. It's 1 out of 8. That's not, that's 12% of the time. Nothing. Absolutely no one accepts Islam. That's not a short period of time for the Prophet alayhi salam not to have anyone accept Islam. However, they were able to stand by one another. Because of the character of the Muslims, because of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's way, people stood their ground. Muslims and non-Muslims alike stayed there. They stood their ground. They refused to give up, and they refused to succumb for 3 full years, even though people died. And at any point, you could have left. Just one word. You say one word, you get out. You completely disassociate yourself with the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, and you're out. Come out, eat, have your meal. Do it. I mean, people could have just lied about it just to have a meal. People could have just, I disown just to have some food and come back. But no one did it. Like, we don't have on record. Understand how weird this is? Like, I don't even know if, keep this all here so you have something. Yeah. I need you to comprehend how awkward or how absurd this story is. No one left. Like in all the books of Sirah, the books of Sirah will tell every story that exists, whether it has a proper chain of narration or if it doesn't, whether it's authentic or it's just made up. They'll tell you, I don't have a story in any of the books of Sirah that talk about people who left. No one left. Everyone stayed. Absolutely everyone stayed. They offered Khadija, if you don't want to stay here, you don't have to. She stayed willingly. Khadija said, they told Khadija, even if you don't want to, don't disown anything. Whenever you want to leave and come back, do whatever you want. It's up to you. Whenever you want to come out, just don't. You're not allowed to take anything in, but you can do whatever you want. Never did. She never did. She stayed with the Prophet the whole time. But she could have, but she didn't. She didn't. Just help give him up, the Prophet, or give up his idea. Yeah, you say, disassociate yourself from this whole movement, and you're free. You're free. You can leave the clan. And so some people who lived outside of the neighborhood anyways. So after a year, they go and said, well, we've stood our ground. This doesn't seem to be going anywhere. They disassociate themselves and go with their homes. They didn't. There's a lot in that is worth reflection. Like the fact that it didn't happen. There's a few reasons, in my opinion. Number one, the respect they had to their family, to their tribe, to Abu Talib, that requested something from them. So they would do it, even if it meant that they were going to lose their, their lives, or their wealth was going to go away, or their status, they still did it. Number two is that they recognized in the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's movement, even though many of them didn't believe in it or weren't a part of it, they recognized the purity of it. They recognized the fact that there's merit to it, and that he has the right to express it alayhi salatu wasalam. And those who are trying to forcefully silence him shouldn't be doing that. They recognized dhulm. They recognized an act of oppression that was occurring. The Prophet ﷺ and the Muslims were being oppressed by Quraysh. There are people who are like that. They're like, I'm not on this side, I'm not on that side, but they can recognize oppression. And there were people who recognized oppression and they stood by the Prophet ﷺ and the Muslims for 3 years, and they lost lives. People died. I'm trying to get you to, I'm saying it, and I'm hoping that you're thinking about like our situation. Like, we are on a side. And then there's the opposing side. There's a lot of people in the middle who don't really care. Like they don't care like about the struggle that Muslims have versus those who want to remove Muslims from the world or from their lands or from whatever. They just don't care about it. But they recognize when there's oppression. They recognize when there's oppression. And they're willing to stand up against oppression.
The problem is, are Muslims capable of embracing people like that? Are you capable of embracing those who stand by you when they see that you're being mistreated? Well, that requires a few things. Number one, it requires an understanding of the world that is not tunnel visioned, and that is not extremely biased, or that lacks general rahmah, compassion and kindness towards others. The Muslims who were in the clan, they had all that. They didn't tell the mushrikeen, the people who stood by them, who weren't Muslim, they didn't tell them things that would repel them from standing by them. And they didn't say, we don't need anyone. They didn't say that. We say stuff like that sometimes. We do. Of course we need support. We need support of those who are just and righteous in this world, who may not necessarily follow our faith, aren't a part of us. We partner with those people. The Prophet ﷺ, I'm sure, did. For 3 years, he partnered with these people. He allowed them to protect him. He didn't have to. He could have said, nope, only one protects me is Allah, and you guys can all, you're all mushrikeen, you're all najas anyway, so go do something. He didn't. This is important. You have to have the ability to partner with people who differ from you in terms of faith, and if you don't have the ability to do that, then we have a problem. this can't actually occur. And you have to be someone who is just when you have the upper hand later. If someone stands by you because they see that you're being treated unfairly, that requires you to be someone who lives for fairness. So when you have the upper hand, you're not going to go do something unfair. You're not going to be the zalim later on. If you have a mazlum and a zalim, someone who is oppressed and an oppressor, you take the sword from the hand of the oppressed and you give it to the oppressor. If the oppressed now becomes the oppressor, what was the point of that? What? Are you enjoying it? Just enjoying watching things for a bit, and then maybe take it and give it this way, and just watch the. The oppressed, in order for the oppressed to be able to welcome the support they have from those who don't necessarily agree with everything that they have, they have to be fair. They have to be people who, once they have the upper hand, will not oppress others. If they've already made the intention that if we end up having the ability, we will. We're going to burn everything to the ground, then no one's going to stand by you. No one wants to stand by your potential oppressor. No one wants to stand by a potential transgressor. You're just a zalim in disguise. You're just waiting for your chance to become a zalim like the other one. I don't want to stand by you. It's one of the reasons why we don't have good partnerships these days as Muslims. Because we lack the understanding of righteousness. In order for you to be able to, first of all, you have to have the capacity to partner with those who don't agree with you on everything. But also you have to understand that people partner with those who feel are righteous. Are Muslims not righteous? Are Muslims not about justice and fairness? Of course we are. But if Islam is, but if Muslims aren't, then we have another issue. Are you understanding the problem? If the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam message was, once I am capable, I am going to kill all of these Qurayshi people who stood against me. You think Banu Hashim would stay with them? Like, oh, bro, I don't know. I don't want to be a part of that. That's not why we're helping you. We think that you're mistreated, so you should be defended. But what you're saying is really weird. What do you mean you're going to kill everybody? No, that's not the point. Was that his message, alayhi salatu wasalam? No, it was the opposite. His message was absolutely the opposite. These are our family. We nasbir alayhim, unahdihim, unad'u lahum. That's how he went by. The people who were oppressing him, he would continuously make dua for them, that Allah will guide them. And he would hope that they find their way eventually. He fight back. He pushes back, alayhi salatu wasalam, defends himself. But he hopes that they find guidance. It's because of that they were able to make this partnership work. And I think that's very, very valuable. All it took was one word. And I think one of the questions we have to ask ourselves, would you have been able to stay there for 3 years? Now again, they didn't know it was 3 years. I'm telling you, it's 3 years. They didn't know. As far as they knew, they were going to stay there until they died. Now the stories are quite graphic, and I don't even know if I could share this with you or not, but I'll share it with you. I'll try to make it less graphic. Sa'd tells us a story, Ibn Abi Waqqas tells us one of the stories, explains to us a little bit how bad it was. How bad it was. He goes out at night to urinate, to do his business. So when you're doing that out in the, it's not in a proper bathroom, you're doing it in a small hole, the sound of water hitting soil is different than the sound of water hitting a rock, different than the sound of water hitting a leaf, different, like, if you camped, you know what I'm talking about. So Sa'd would go out and he would do his business and he would hear the sound of the liquid, not hitting soil, but something different. So once he was finished in the night, he's looking and he finds a piece of goat skin that, forgive me, someone had urinated on.
يقول فما فرحت بشيء فرحي بها. I was the happiest person on the planet with it. فأخذتها فغسلتها ونظفتها. I took it and I washed it and I took care of it and I used it and we made broth out of it and we used it for a week. Used it for a week. This is what Sa'd. Do you understand it? What degree of hunger must occur for something like that to happen, right? What degree of hunger can? Yeah. Another narration for this story, or something similar, was where one of the Sahaba would find something, like find a date or something, and he would be very happy with it. And in his mind, he's like, "Oh, I'm going to go eat this." And he turns around, and he finds the Prophet standing there, smiling at him, telling him, "Wahdak, you're going to." Alone, فَقَالَا يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهُ إِنَّمَا مَعِي النَّاسِ I'm going to go and feed, I'm going to go and share it with everyone around me. But that's how hungry they were. One of the, something to add like to this, and these are just, I'm just giving you points to think about. This is a very hard part of his seerah, alayhi salatu wasalam. It's very difficult, it's very pragmatic, and it's very relevant today. But it's hard to tell because of how difficult talking about hunger is. How difficult talking about people dying from starvation or dying from lack of basic human decency. When it occurs, when children die and perish and people perish from that, and there's no reason, that it's hard to tell this story. But the thing is, there was no miracles, right? Like, I'll tell you a story later on, like maybe in a couple of months, where Jibreel will actually bring something to one of the Sahaba, like grapes or something like that, something to eat. Miraculously, something the Prophet ﷺ would put his hand in the well, and the water would come gushing out. The Prophet ﷺ would feed an army from a small amount of in the day of Khandaq. All these little things. Nothing. 3 years, nothing. Like no one. Jibreel did not bring any provision. It would have been nice, wouldn't it? It would spite them. I would like telling that story. I would have enjoyed. I would find that story fun. And then Quraysh tried to starve Banu Hashim and the clan for a few years, but every time they looked in, Banu Hashim were having a feast. They're having a big feast because Jibreel brought food. And now the people on the outside want to go on the inside to eat. They're not even playing this story. They didn't even come up with No, that's not what happened. No miracles occurred. Nothing. And you start wondering, well, why not? Because al-haq is haq. Righteousness is very, very, very valuable. It's very expensive. For you to, the reason that this happened is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had to put this early Sahaba to this test of how far are you willing to go for what is righteous? How far are you willing to stand your ground for what you believe is the truth? Let's see. Let's see how far you'll go. Yeah. Let's see if you're truthful about this. To what degree, how much are you willing to sacrifice for the sake of the truth? For the sake of al-haq? For the sake of Islam? How much? So they are put to the test. Yeah. Alhamdulillah, we don't have these. This is not your test, or it's not mine either. Ours is much more, it's much less complicated. Ours is knowledge and education and mentorship and advocacy and other stuff that don't. This was hard, Yashikh. This was very, very hard for 3 years for them to put up with this. I can imagine so many breaking points where you just say, you know what? This ain't worth it. This isn't worth it. I can't watch my family perish. I'm out. May Allah strengthen you. May Allah grant you, inshallah, once you have your state, Ya Rasulullah, I'll come to you then. But I can't. Rabbi wafiqkum. My heart is with you. And then take your family and leave. But they didn't. They didn't. They all stayed there. And it was a test. No miracles, because no. We're not gonna bail you out. Either you stand your ground or you don't. This was the early part of, that's why other things came along. Like during Khandaq and during these small little evidences of his prophecy, alayhi salatu wasalam, mini miracles you can call them, occurred, but they occurred upon a people who had already established their weight, their merit, their ability to actually, the Sahaba had already gone through enough. Like it was clear the fact that they valued righteousness, they valued Islam, they valued the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's life. If you think about it, that's really what's being valued here the most. He's protecting his life, alayhi salatu wasalam. That's why they stayed there. Nope. If this means he's more protected, then we all stay. Even if our children suffer, even if we die, then we stay, because he has to stay protected, alayhi salatu wasalam. They had to prove that love for him and that dedication to his message, alayhi salatu wasalam. One of the ahadith narrated in the collection of Imam Ahmad, and has an authentic chain narration. This is what he said, alayhi salatu wasalam. يقول, he said this towards the end of his life. قال لقد أخفت في الله وما يخاف أحد ولقد أذيت في الله وما يؤذى أحد ولقد أتت علي ثلاثون من بين يوم وليلة وما لي ولبلال طعام يأكله ذو كبد إلا شيء يواريه إبط بلال. So he would say, there came a time during this whole story, this da'wah, where I was put in a state of fear for the sake of Allah, and no one else was. I mean, no one was put it in a state of fear as much as I was. Meaning my life was constantly being threatened. Nothing came similar. And I was harmed for the sake of Allah in a way where no one was harmed. Like everyone else was being harmed, but not to the degree that I was being harmed at the time. Because alayhi salatu wasalam was being harmed physically and socially and financially and via his reputation and his family and in almost every way possible. Yani, if you run through a difficulty in one avenue of your life, you struggle. Imagine losing everything all at once. Like, if someone gets fired from their job, that's a big musibah and you need to support them. Imagine getting fired from your job and going through a divorce and losing a family member and being evicted from your home. Like, these are the stories where people end up homeless under under a bridge with needles in their arms. This is what happened. The Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam would be put in situations where he's losing everything all at once. It would all happen when it rains, it pours. And then because the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's character is, he made it seem like it didn't happen. Like, he did it so gracefully that he made it seem easy, and he makes us not think about it, alayhi salatu wasalam. But he would lose literally everything, all within a short period of time. And I'll show you that. That's why the 10th year is called the year of grief. And I'll show you, because people could not help but to notice that this has not been a good year for you, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam ajma'in. And for him, it was like any other year, but things happened clearly to others that they were able to actually see into his life for a moment. But things like that were always happening to him, alayhi salam. So for him, it didn't make a difference. Year 10 is the year that launched Islam into the world. It got Islam to Yathrib. So for people, it was the year of grief. For him, it was just another year that he was working, alayhi salatu wasalam. Anyways, so you say, and I was harmed at a level that no one else was being harmed at. And then he said, and 30 days and nights came by, and nothing entered my stomach or the stomach of Bilal except whatever Bilal was able to hide under his armpit. Bilal, not being from Bani Hashim and being a slave, was allowed to go in and out because he's a slave. This is where corrupt social laws work in your work for you. All free people aren't allowed in and out, but slaves, no one cares. So they could go in and out freely. They had to be padded down, though. So Bilal was not allowed to bring anything in. He couldn't bring food in, but he could leave and enter freely. And Bilal, he could leave, but he didn't eat. Bilal would not eat when he was on the outside. He refused to eat, because if the Prophet ﷺ wasn't eating, he wasn't eating. That's how his mindset was. If he's not eating, I'm not eating. But he would try and bring some food in. And the only place he could hide it is he would put it under his armpit. Take a few dates, a date or two, and as he's being patted down, he just keeps that muscle nice and tense to kill. And the Prophet ﷺ, for 30 days, he and Bilal, that's all they would eat. Imagine eating something that was in an armpit. Anyone's armpit, doesn't matter whose. But seriously, think about this. How hungry do you need to be to overlook the fact that this existed in an armpit for any period of time? For any period of time, even if it's Sayyidina Bilal radiallahu anhu. But that's how hungry they got. And for 30 days and 30 nights, that's all he had, alayhi salam. That's all he could, whatever Bilal could bring in every couple of days, and under his armpit, is that what they ate? That's it. This is how hungry they became. This is how bad it was. Abu Talib is still inside the neighborhood, and they move him around, alayhi salatu wasalam, every night. Every few nights, they move his place. Why? Just in case Quraysh is, at night sending in people to look around, trying to figure out where he is. Because Quraysh made it clear, make it open, that they were going to assassinate him. They were still trying. So Abu Talib, his whole goal, all he did during that time is just keep the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam safe. So he made sure every second night he would move around. This is the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam's life for 3 years. He's not living in his home. He's not in a stable position for 3 years. He has to move around constantly because that's for his own safety. Khadija radiallahu anha, she could leave, didn't, like Bilal. She could leave, she didn't. She stayed with him. And she starved like everyone else, radiallahu anha. And she could leave and get some food, but she didn't. I'll end with this story because I think it's time for Maghrib. Perfect, I like this story. There's a man by the name of Hisham ibn Amr al-Amiri. So Hisham, he wasn't Muslim. We don't know for sure if he ever accepted Islam. Some scholars say he did. And I hope to Almighty God, I pray to Almighty God that he did. I really pray that this man accepted Islam at some point in his life. It's going to hurt me if he didn't. Yeah, at this time he was not Muslim, right? And Hisham, after two and a half years, Hisham started the movement of, he started the ending of this. And how he did, he's like, I can't do this anymore. This is inhumane. It's insane. I can't put up with it. So he would take a camel and pack the camel with food. Or he would walk, he would walk the camel back and forth from his house to an entrance into the clan of Bani Hashim until the camel memorized the way. And then he would basically pack this camel with food and then slap it in the middle of the night and the camel go running, right? And in the middle of the night, no one's there and the camel run right into the clan of Hashim, they would eat. So they caught him. He did it the first night, second night, and then they caught him. And they beat him. Like they slap him, and he's not one of the, you know, the elders or the nobles. So they're slapping him, and they're asking him, "What asabat? Yaqulu la. Did you lose? Are you Muslim now? No. Aghadart? Are you betraying us? La. Qal ma tasna idan? Qala inna hadha laqat'un lirrahim. Said no, but this is qat'u rahim. We're starving our Banu Hashim, our relatives. We're starving them. This is not appropriate. Faqala la ta'ud ilayha. Don't do this again. So he says okay, and he doesn't do it for a few nights, and then he just can't help it. Does the same thing, takes the camel, walks it back for a couple of times, pack it with food, and sends it on the way in. They catch him, they beat him up. Second time they beat him up a little bit more severely. He has a concussion, doesn't get up for a couple of weeks. The time he can get up again, he does it again. This time they catch him and they almost kill him. Before they kill him, I'm not sure I put this here or not, but Abu Sufyan comes in. Before they kill him, Abu Sufyan intervenes. The scholars say that this is one of the reasons, one of the two reasons why Abu Sufyan accepted Islam later on in his life, is the barakah of, it's the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala rewarding him for a few things he did. And what he did at that moment, قَالَ دَعُوهُ دَعُوهُ فَإِنَّمَا يَصِلُ رَحِمَهُ. Leave him, don't kill him. And you can stop him, don't kill him. He's just doing salat rahim. Like, think about what you're doing. You're beating someone for trying to feed starving people. Think about what you're doing. I understand, we don't want him to do it, but think of what you're doing. You're going to kill someone for trying to feed these starving people. دعوه لا تفسدوا. He said, لا تفسدوا علينا كل أخلاقنا. Don't ruin all of our ethics. Like, don't ruin all of our ethics. Like, leave something. We can't, you know, we're doing this. Yeah, we're doing this fine, but don't ruin everything. Don't kill someone for trying to feed them. I mean, you have to have a line somewhere. قال لا تفسدوا علينا كل أخلاقنا. There are scholars who swear that this is why Abu Sufyan accepted Islam later. They swear that this is why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala granted him Islam later in his life for the words that he said on that day. And yeah, لا تفسدوا علينا. Don't ruin all ethics. You want to kill people, starve them too, and then hold back. And that's what's left. What's left of morality if you do that? Like, what's left of anything if that's acceptable? And that was the beginning of how this will end. But at that point, there was still no telling when it'll end. We'll continue this story, inshallah ta'ala. We won't run next week. Next week is the week of Eid. I selfishly take that week off. We will come back the week after, inshallah ta'ala. I hope you found this helpful. Subhanak Allah, bihamdik, shayna la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa sallallahu wa sallam wa baraka ala nabiyyina Muhammadin wa alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Jazakumullahu khair, barakallahu fikum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh.